they need to be stricter, more harsh penalties for people like that who puts greed and money over human life.
I agree.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove, out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, out in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950, the KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota, and of course, coast to coast and around the world, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation Radio, or not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and blanketing the globe 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik. This is your Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another action-packed, thrilling adventure. Just before air on yesterday's Bradcast, we got word that the once incredibly powerful West Virginia coal baron, Don Blankenship, was sentenced for his part in the deaths of 29 miners back in 2010 in April, just 6 years ago, this month. That 29 miners died in that explosion at the Upper Big Branch coal mine in West Virginia. It devastated the community. It very briefly riveted the nation for just a few days in April before the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. Not a good month for fossil fuels. That killed 11 people, drew the media's attention, understandably, I suppose, for the next several months as they watched that unstoppable oil leak. But Don Blankenship, who as CEO of Massey Energy, one of the nation's largest coal companies at the time, had scoffed for years at mine safety regulations. And late last year, he was found guilty for conspiracy to willfully violate safety standards at the Upper Big Branch mine that led directly to that to those 29 deaths. Blankenship received the maximum sentence yesterday, just before we went to air, for what he was found guilty of, which, unless he is successful on appeal, that sentence will amount to one single year in jail. 29 dead miners, 1 year in jail for the coal boss whose actions led directly to it. We will go out to coal country momentarily to speak with our old friend Bob Kincaid in West Virginia about the sentencing, about the tragedy, about Blankenship, and about, frankly, what is really going on right now in coal country amidst this this pretend war on coal. Is that the right way to describe it, Desi Doyen? A pretend war on coal? Is there a war on coal going on?
There is no war on coal going on.
I wish there was, at least not in this country.
It's called the free market.
Oh, there's that, yeah. Well, we'll find out what's actually going on in coal country and how Bob Kincaid is surviving this deadly war on coal that Republicans enjoy claiming that Obama is waging. We'll get to that momentarily. Yesterday, we also had played the comments from this congressman, this Republican congressman, Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin, on WTMJ, the Milwaukee NBC affiliate up there. Grothman was asked about how Republicans could possibly win the presidential race in November, since, you know, Democrats have won Wisconsin election after election up there in the presidential election in any event. And Grothman cited, of course, the draconian photo ID voting restrictions that were in place in Wisconsin on Tuesday for the first time in a major election up there. And of course, they led to long, hours-long lines in many areas where students in particular were voting because most of the student IDs were not amongst the allowable ones. Even though these students were legally registered to vote, 300,000 legally registered voters don't have the type of ID now required in Wisconsin. And that is all because Republicans are pretending there's some sort of voter fraud epidemic that might be deterred by these by photo ID, when in fact it is merely a way to keep legitimate lawful voters, if largely Democratic leaning ones, from being able to cast their vote at all. Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker up there, his fellow Republicans, they were unable to show a single case of voter fraud in Wisconsin's recent history that might have been deterred by this type of a law during the long trial that went on, in which the federal judge found that this law, in fact, was in violation of the Voting Rights Act, is a violation of the Constitution, and yet an appellate court allowed the law to go forward anyway. Here was Congressman Grothman when he was asked about this law on WTMJ on Election Day, Tuesday of this week. And he said out loud what Republicans are not supposed to say about these laws.
You know that a lot of Republicans since 1984 in the presidential races have not been able to win in Wisconsin. Why would it be any different for Ted Cruz or Donald Trump?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up. And now we have photo ID. And I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well.
Oh, do you? Do you think so, Congressman? Setting aside the comment about Hillary Clinton, because I actually just don't care to deal with that right now. I want to look at what he said. What he said. Now, I know that many listeners out there might prefer that I talk about, you know, whatever dumb thing that Donald Trump had to say today, or frankly, how horrible Hillary Clinton is, or whatever political nonsense story of the day is out there. But, you know, for all of this Sturm and Drang, you can find that. You can find that on every other radio show, television show. That's what you can find, bickering about the politics. And we do that here as well. Well, you know, we do that on the broadcast. But all of this Sturm and Drang over elections and the horse races don't mean a thing if voters cannot vote at the end of the day. And Grothman is right. Keeping 300,000 registered voters from being able to cast their vote this November could actually flip the state from Democratic to Republican. And those 300,000, as I said, those are just the registered voters. Never mind the eligible. There's many more who are not registered who may want to register between now and November, who also don't have the type of photo ID that is necessary now to vote in Wisconsin. So, yeah, you know, I've heard from some listeners, why are you always whining about this? And that was the word. That was a word that a Twitter user used yesterday after our broadcast yesterday. It was a word that Joe Scarborough used. He tweeted he wanted to know if people could stop whining now about photo ID rules now that there was record turnout in the Wisconsin primary on Tuesday. No, we cannot. No, we cannot stop whining about it, Joe. We cannot stop whining when people lose their right to vote. And make no mistake, people did lose their right to vote on Tuesday. Many of them, and it will happen again in November. It doesn't matter how large the turnout was. That is not an indication of how many people had their rights stolen. Scott Walker said something similar. The photo ID law worked just fine. Well, it didn't work. Well, maybe it did. For Scott Walker, it did work just fine. Here's a story. Leroy Switlick. He has voted for 46 years in his hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But Switlick, who is legally blind, was unable to obtain a piece of photo ID that would comply with the state's strict new voter ID law in order to cast a regular ballot in Tuesday's primary. Despite Walker's claim that the state's photo ID law, quote, works just fine, some voters were actually prevented from voting on Tuesday. And the burdens were disproportionately felt by low-income voters, people of color, seniors, people with disability, and yes, students. When Switlick went to the DMV to obtain an ID card to try to vote, according to Samantha Lackman at Huffington Post, he brought his birth certificate with him, a utility bill, a property tax statement, and a Medicare card. He's voted in Wisconsin since he was 21 years old. He's now 67, and remember, he's blind. He said he went up there to the counter, and the gentleman behind the counter said, "This stuff is no good. You've got to have a picture ID. How do I know you are who you say you are?" So, Switlet's documents proved his name and date of birth, his Wisconsin residency, his citizenship, but they didn't prove his identity, according to this guy. He needed a piece of ID with his photo and signature, like a passport, but he had none of the quote-unquote acceptable documents to get this photo ID. He said, "How do I get an ID card if I don't have an ID card?" He ultimately decided to vote, as Switlik did, for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton with a provisional ballot. And now he's hoping to get an ID to make his ballot count before the Friday afternoon deadline. So if you cast a provisional vote in Wisconsin because you didn't have the ID, you still have until Friday afternoon to try to get an ID and to bring it in. That is not easy to do for many people. Kerry Venteris of Madison also had to vote with a provisional ballot on Tuesday. The 41-year-old has a disability that makes it difficult for her to get around. She moved from Illinois to Wisconsin in December and hadn't yet had a chance to get a Wisconsin driver's license. When a friend told her that she couldn't actually vote with her Illinois license, remember, she has one in Illinois, and they're not supposed to be checking your residency on these matters. So we know it's her. But this is the rules that they made in order to keep people, that the Republicans passed in order to keep people from casting a vote. So when she heard that she couldn't vote with her Illinois license, she contacted the Wisconsin chapter of election protection. Her birth certificate, however, is that she would need in order to get this Wisconsin ID, that birth certificate's in Illinois. So she wasn't able to get an acceptable form of photo ID before the primary. So now she's taking a bus back to Illinois. She went back on Wednesday afternoon back to Illinois to get her birth certificate, which is a 3-hour round trip. And she estimated the cost of getting the provisional ballot that she can get her provisional ballot to count before Friday's deadline. That will add up to roughly $100 in addition to all of those hours. I could go on and on with these stories. So when I hear people telling me, Joe Scarborough, "Hey, can we stop whining? There was plenty of turnout. Plenty of people turned out." That's not how rights work. And the fact that the guy who is on MSNBC for some 4 hours a day, this Republican congressman, remember, this is the quote-unquote liberal network, MSNBC, right? It's just like Fox News, except it's for liberals. Except I'm pretty sure there is not a Democrat who is on the air on Fox News for 4 goddamn hours every morning with his own show to spout all manner of nonsense the way Joe Scarborough is here. So you want to know what's really going on with that law? As if, I've been telling you for years, voting rights advocates have been telling you for years. Republican Congressman Grothman just hinted at it when he said, "Yeah, well, now we're going to win. Now we're going to win because this is going to keep enough Democrats away from the polls in November." So here's what's really going on. Todd Albaugh, who used to work in the Wisconsin State Senate, he was a Republican chief of staff there, and he quit the Republican Party. He was there in 2011, when Republicans passed this bill initially that has been tied up in the courts ever since and then was finally used on Tuesday. Todd Albaugh, I think this was on election day. Yeah, on primary day. He took to his Facebook, and Albaugh told what these laws are really about. I'm going to just read you what he said, what he posted in full on Facebook on primary day. Again, the Republican chief of staff at the Wisconsin State Senate. He said, "You want to know why I left the Republican Party as it exists today? Here it is. This was the last straw. I was in the closed Senate Republican caucus when the final round of multiple voter ID bills were being discussed. A handful of the GOP senators were giddy about the ramifications and literally singled out the prospects of suppressing minority and college voters." They were giddy about it. Think about that for a minute, Albaugh writes. Elected officials planning and happy to help deny a fellow American's constitutional right to vote in order to increase their own chances to hang on to power. A vigorous debate on the ideas was not good enough. Inspiring the electorate and relying on their agenda being better to get people to vote for them, that was not good enough. No, they had to take the coward's way out and come up with a plan to suppress the vote under the guise of, quote, voter fraud. The truth, he writes, there was almost none. Oh, wait. GOP Speaker Voss's estranged wife voted twice in both, and GOP Speaker Voss is a Republican. She voted twice in both Idaho and Wisconsin, and a GOP staffer was caught voting twice. And I should add that the photo ID law wouldn't have prevented either of those cases of actual voter fraud carried out by Republicans from having occurred. Albaugh continues, but it was good rhetoric. Yesterday, one of my employees, born in California, went to get his Wisconsin ID. He was told he couldn't use his California ID to get a Wisconsin ID without his birth certificate, which is back in California. Sound familiar? The result? He's not able to vote today. Here's a young man in his early 20s who is taking part and interested in voting for the first time in his life. He was excited to go to the polls. What kind of a state, a legislature, a political party is it that denies this young man his right, says Albaugh. The GOP, he writes, was born out of greater opportunity and equality. Wisconsin, yes, the Wisconsin Republican Party under the leadership of Republican Governor Robert M. Fighting Bob La Follette led the country in creating greater voting access to its citizens. The Wisconsin GOP was seen as a shining example of equality. That was the party I joined in the 80s and fought for. That party, he says, no longer exists. I don't belong to any party now. I don't think the Dems have all the answers either. But my God, to watch a party I once fought for deny a young man his voting rights, it boils my blood, leaves a pit in my stomach. It's time for a GOP implosion. Wow, huh?
Yeah.
That was Todd Albaugh, the Wisconsin State Senate chief of staff for the Republic, former chief of staff, explaining why he left the Republican Party. And so, yeah, I'm sorry. No, I'm not. I'm sorry for whining to you all about this, And I've got one story after another story. I want to get to Bob Kincaid here shortly, so I'm not gonna. I won't go into it. Into more of these stories of these, you know, these people, these students who were voting for the first time and who said, this is ridiculous what we have to go through. We had to wait an hour in line to get a photo ID, then another 2 hours to be able to cast our vote. And these are people, by the way, who are voting for the first time, who are looking at this and saying, this is democracy. This, I'm trying to do my part, but man, this is ridiculous. So a lot of these people, they're not going to go through it again, and I would not blame them. So, yeah, this stuff matters. We will continue to cover it here on the broadcast, whether you like it or not, because this stuff matters, and because voting matters, and democracy matters. And yeah, we have a lot of really crappy candidates on not just the Republican side, but on the Democratic side. Yeah. But that's not the point. The point is, if we can't participate in our system, we can't fix it. And if we don't participate in our system, if we stop participating in our system, then we will never fix it. Then we have no choice. Then you can have politicians, both Republicans and Democratic, who can run roughshod over we the people as they do, as they have now for years, for decades in West Virginia, where arguably there's not a dime's worth of difference sometimes, particularly when it comes to the coal industry, between the Republicans and the Democrats up there in West Virginia. And of course, it is we the people who pay the price for that. The literal price, the worst price, the ultimate price, the price of death in many cases. And that's what we're going to talk about next in West Virginia, with our friend Bob Kincaid. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Don't miss our next conversation. It's important. Stay tuned.
West Virginia coal, gonna take you on a ride. Gonna take you to the city, to the shore and countryside. Gonna let you work your magic and your power and your pride. West Virginia coal, you're on your way.
Yeah. When we go down deep through the dark today, we come up with a light for America.
Yeah.
America.
That's an actual ringtone that you can download from the West Virginia Coal Association. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I think the most accurate part there is when they say coal, West Virginia coal is going to take you on a ride.
Coal is West Virginia.
Yep, it sure is. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. 6 years and one day after Massey Energy Company's Upper Big Branch mine exploded in West Virginia, killing 29 men, Don Blankenship stood in federal court and tried to express his sorrow to the miners' families. That, according to the Charleston Gazette-Mail in West Virginia, he said the lost coal miners were great coal miners. Blankenship, the former Massey CEO, is a towering figure in coal country, or at least he used to be. For the families of victims, according to the paper, many of whom sat through Blankenship's entire two-month trial, it was not nearly enough. Not nearly. U.S. District Court Irene Berger gave Blankenship the maximum allowable sentence for his actions leading up to the explosion on Wednesday of this week. 1 year in prison, 1 year of supervised release, and $250,000 fine for the millionaire coal baron. For that, the families of the victims were thankful, but the apology and the relative lightness of the maximum allowable sentence, 1 year in prison for willfully conspiring to violate mine safety standards, did not sit well. As Blankenship left the Robert C. Byrd U.S. courthouse on Wednesday afternoon, several family members of victims of the Upper Big Branch mine explosion commented their emotions were still raw 6 years later, and they did not hold back as Blankenship came out of the courthouse. Tommy Davis, who lost his brother, his son, and his nephew at the Upper Big Branch, reached above the scrum of attorneys and news media surrounding Blankenship to point his finger at the man that he blamed for the disaster. Quote, "You don't have a heart. You don't miss your kids like we miss ours." Davis, who was working in a different section of that same mine that same day, shouted at Blankenship as he left. He said, "I hold a picture. I hold a tombstone. You hold nothing." Tommy Davis spoke to reporters after Blankenship drove away.
I lost three there that day.
Who were they again? There?
Charles Timothy Davis. That was my only brother, my go-to guy. My son Corey Thomas, which was only 20, the youngest one out of all of them. And my son Joshua, or my nephew Joshua from Ohio. I was talking to my other nephew at the man trip station when it all went down. And this man has no remorse at all.
Tommy, what were some of the things that you were yelling as he was speaking? We couldn't really...
I don't want him know who I was, because out of 6 years, he never approached none of us. He never told us he was sorry for what happened. And he knows he could have done the right thing. All he had to do was make one of them 40 phone calls a day he called checking on production to say shut it down and fix everything, but he refused to do it.
We can see you're kind of shaking right now. What's going through you?
It's just too much to say. I miss my family. He hugged his, and all he gets is a year, and she done great. She give him what she could give him, but they need to be stricter, more harsh penalties for people like that who puts greed and money over human life.
What did you think when he went up in the court and said that he apologized to you guys?
It mean nothing. It didn't mean nothing, and it still won't mean nothing, because like I told him standing right there when he looked at me, he never come to me in 6 years, never come to me, never come to my mom, my dad. It's gone now. They grieved herself to death. He never come and apologized to none of us. He never said nothing.
Would it have mattered if he did? Would it have changed your opinion on him?
He's still who he is.
Where's this frustration come from for you?
If you was where I was that day, and you seen my son after laying in there for 5 days, and seen what he looked like, if you worked on them men like we did when they come outside and you smelled them and you looked at them, then you know where I come from. You know what's here. Not much.
Tommy, you worked there as well, right?
Yes.
Were you there that day?
Yes, I was. I was in at the Mantrip station trying to early out. But I got to feel only a little bit what a whole lot of these men felt a whole lot of. And that man has no remorse for human life at all.
That was Miner Tommy Davis in West Virginia speaking after the sentencing of coal baron Don Blankenship to just 1 year in jail following the deaths of 29 miners in his mine. One family member noted that 365 days in prison for Blankenship amounted to about 12 and a half days for each dead miner. The families were also not moved by Blankenship's apology in court, where he also reasserted, quote, "I am not guilty of a crime." Joining us now to talk about this and so much more, a man who has been covering Blankenship for years in West Virginia and fighting for the people of the state and the miners who have been treated so horribly for so long by folks like Blankenship and the politicians that he helped put in office for a decade, is our old friend Bob Kincaid. He's co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, president of Coal River Mountain Watch, and the legendary host and creator of the Head On Radio Network. And in addition to being a tireless hero in the fight against mountaintop removal coal mining and other horrific and hopefully quickly dying practices in coal country, Bob's also a longtime friend of both the Brad Blog and the Bradcast. Welcome back, my friend. Great to have you back on the Bradcast, Bob.
It's great to talk to you, Brad.
Bob, you have been covering Don Blankenship, who was described long ago by Rolling Stone, I believe, as the Dark Lord of Coal Country. You've been covering for years out there in West Virginia. Before we get into the specifics of this case, Blankenship is much more than a now-disgraced coal company owner, frankly. This man was a coal baron with tremendous influence, both in the state and even nationally for decades, was he not? Who, in a nutshell, if you can describe it in a nutshell here, who was Blankenship before this tragic disaster at the Upper Big Branch mine in 2010?
Don Blankenship was a man who rose up from relative poverty down in Mingo County,
mm-hmm.
and scrambled his way up through the ranks of Massey, got himself an accounting degree at Marshall University, and set about the business of breaking the union. And he did. He was successful. He turned Massey into a mostly non-union operation in which one raised one's voice about things like safety concerns at one's peril.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, he created a culture of fear and of timidity. And well, he ran his mines. When times were good, we need to remember, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
When times were good, he was hosting humongous rallies in which he wrapped himself in flag decorated shirts and had Ted Nugent playing on a toxic mountaintop removal hellscape, and people loved him. Oh, they thought he was just wonderful.
And literally, I mean, he literally wore a flag hat, flag shirt, and he was having these political rallies out there and was incredibly powerful. Now, why was he, at least that was before his, what appears now to be his downfall, I can only hope it is, why was he only charged with a misdemeanor in this case? If I understand it, that's why he was only able to get 1 year. That was the maximum allowable under what he was charged with. It was a misdemeanor, not a felony, despite the fact that, 29 died. Why is that? I still can't wrap my head around it.
The reason for that, Brad, first of all, he was charged with two crimes. One of them was a felony.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the felony was the charge of having defrauded shareholders or defrauded Wall Street. Now that, in the eyes of the Congress of the United States, is a felony.
Right.
Don't defraud the shareholders, or we will put you under the prison.
Right.
On the other hand, if you dummy up safety regulations that are designed to preserve the lives of people working an incredibly dangerous job, If you dummy up on those, and if you conspire to evade them, and 29 people get turned into human charcoal, that's a misdemeanor. Thank you, Congress.
why was he acquitted then on the felony? He was acquitted on that second charge, the more quote unquote serious charge of defrauding shareholders. Correct?
Yes, he was.
Why? I mean, how did he skate on that one?
He skated on that because the government's case was really complicated, and it turned on questions of his mental state and his intent, and the lawyers that he hired were able to successfully obfuscate around that.
Should he have been charged with more? For example, you know, accessory to murder, essentially here. I mean, could he have been charged with more? Did he receive a pass from federal investigators, or is this a case of years of lobbying by the coal industry and Blankenship himself, leaving, you know, law enforcement with very few tools that they could use to hold this type of person accountable for this kind of disaster?
Well, it's obvious that, you know, things like a murder charge or accessory to murder, those would more likely be state charges.
Okay.
And this is West Virginia, and in many ways West Virginia is a Stalinist sort of state, with the coal industry standing in as the Stalin. there's not a prosecutor in this state, a county prosecutor, who would have had the courage to run up to butt heads with Don Blankenship. So that was sort of out of the picture to begin with. But there were safety regulations, and this was about as close as they could get to him. So it's kind of pathetic, Brad, but it's a landmark because a corporate honcho actually went down. Compare this to because yesterday was an interesting day. Compare this to what happened in the BP Horizon case, because the last guy was sentenced yesterday.
Yeah.
And he was just a lower-level supervisor, and he got 10 months of probation, and he was the supervisor when 11 human beings were blown up on that oil rig.
So I guess we should be happy that someone faced some kind of accountability somewhere. But, of course, in the BP case, they had to pay a much bigger price, in that the settlement was something like $20 billion. But we just get word that BP now gets to write that off, literally write that off as an expense, the cost of doing business.
And I have no doubt. I'm not an accountant, but I'm guessing that Don Blankenship will write the $250,000 fine off on his taxes, too.
A lot of people don't realize that explosion in the Gulf came just days after this disaster up in West Virginia, and that sort of sucked up a lot of the 15 days. And everyone remembers that Gulf disaster. Not many, unfortunately, remember what happened in West Virginia. The family members, of course, do. They, however, family members of the miners, were not allowed to speak in court at the sentencing. Some were very upset about that. Even though Don Blankenship, he was allowed to speak in court. Any idea why they were not allowed to express their thoughts as the family members of victims?
I'm only guessing, Brad, but I'm guessing that the federal judge was trying to keep any potential error from entering the record, because Blankenship has already said that he's going to appeal, and he'll take that appeal up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. In addition, the judge turned away 80 victims' compensation claims against Blankenship, and she also turned away a victims' compensation claim filed by Alpha Natural Resources to the tune of $23 million that they said that Alpha Natural Resources, the corporation, and of course corporations are people now, my friend.
Yes,
they stepped up and said, "We're a victim. We need $23 million. The judge bounced that, too.
And Alpha Natural Resources ended up buying, as I understand, Massey Energy, which had been one of the largest coal companies, now Alpha is.
They're in bankruptcy.
Yeah, I was going to say, they filed for bankruptcy protection. We're going to talk in a little bit. I'm speaking with Bob Kincaid, of West Virginia, about the this Blankenship case, and I want to talk about what's actually going on in a broader picture with coal country. But a few more points on this Blankenship, because this is a guy, I mean, you know, boy, what, 10 years ago, no one ever would have thought that Blankenship would have been brought down like this. When you hear someone, responses from folks like that miner Tommy Davis, who lost his son, his nephew, his brother in that disaster, what do you think when you hear that? I mean, from out here, it's absolutely heartbreaking. You've known these people, worked with these people for years. Were you moved or surprised by the response to their family members?
It breaks my heart, because it's another chapter in the 125-plus year-long exploitation and devastation of the people of this state and this region, Brad. We have to remember that the number of people killed in coal mine accidents, killed by black lung, the various other diseases, it numbers in the tens of thousands. Other regions of this country have probably suffered their own abuse at the hands of corporate America, but they're going to have to get up awful early in the morning to match the wholesale suffering of Appalachia over the course of the last century. Of course it's heartbreaking, it's heartrending. And Tommy Davis was right. The judge did all that she could. But the fact of the matter is, if we had a responsible Congress, and I realize that using responsible and Congress in the same sentence is an exercise in futility at this point, but if we had a responsible Congress, we would be looking at regulations like the ones that and the safety regs and the criminal penalties for evading them that Don Blankenship was convicted of, and we would, maybe make those felities and not misdemeanors. But to the best of my knowledge, in 6 years, that has not happened.
Well, to that end, and I want to be very careful here, because I don't want to... I don't want to come across as somehow blaming the victims at all. But when I see, people responding out there, when I see people in West Virginia, you know, Tommy Davis, he was a miner as well. Aren't folks like that, everyday citizens and workers who are just trying to hold a job and feed their families in rural West Virginia area, working as miners in places like, you know, not just West Virginia, but Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Ohio. To some extent, those folks are also the ones who kept these politicians in power on both the Republican and the Democratic side in places like West Virginia, who made it easy for guys
sure
like Blankenship to get away with this. So do the people of coal country bear some responsibility here in what has happened over these decades you're talking about?
I guess to a certain extent, we're always good. Anyone anywhere is an author of their own doom in that regard, Brad. It's painful. I mean, I can look back in my family history and just see one-line entries, died in the mines, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather died in part because of black lung disease.
Yeah.
My father labored in the mines and told me as a child... I don't ever want you to do what I had to do.
But people like you have taken a lot of grief for speaking out, for pushing back, for trying to do something about it. We've watched these, you know, wars out there for years over your fight against mountaintop removal. And a lot of times it is the very people who are most at risk out there who come after people like you, Bob.
Oh, sure. I was going to mention that, you know, we've held rallies and protests against mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that some of the people who were aggrieved at Don Blankenship were the same people who were who were given paid days off to come and scream at the tree huggers. There's no doubt about that. I mean, like I said, I live in a very strange place. I mean, climate change is a vile liberal Obama conspiracy to take away our coal jobs here. I mean, that's just how it is. And, yeah, what you said about the way they vote, in 2014, they ran. They did not walk. They ran to the polls to elect a slate of Republicans on the principle that the Republicans said they were going to make the coal come back. Well, I don't know what. Maybe they were going to put cattle prods to the little Keebler coal elves and make them make more coal underground. You know, it's a finite resource, and we don't get that here.
It seems that that they don't. Even after tragedies like this, you would think they would throw all of these bums out and demand much more. I got to take a quick break here. I'm going to come back with Bob Kincaid, co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, president of Coal River Mountain Watch, and host of the Bob Kincaid Show on the Head On Radio Network. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com speaking with my friend, the great Bob Kincaid, host of Head On Radio on the Head On Radio Network. And a great activist for years, for decades, frankly, out there in West Virginia fighting against the coal barons and the death traps, frankly, that they send folks into. Bob, during the break, and I want to get to some of these bigger coal country issues, but during the break we were talking about, Blankenship and the fact that though he has been brought down, though he has been now hopefully sent away to jail for at least a year in the wake of the deaths of 29 miners at his mine back in 2010, that the safety regulations are still lacking, and the enforcement of those regulations is still lacking. And you said this same problem is going to happen again. It seems like we never learn.
Well, of course it's going to happen again, because Don Blankenship was not the only coal boss who hates safety regulations. Remember, here in West Virginia and generally in the Republican Party, those are not safety regulations that Don Blankenship conspired to evade. Those are job-killing regulations, mm-hmm. Brad.
Yeah, that is how they see them, and they actually see, concerns about climate change as Obama's war on coal. I wish he did have more of a war on coal, frankly. And I want to.
I would welcome it.
Yes, no kidding. We need one. However, I think there is, a bright spot here. I think that coal is finally on its way out, and let me get to that in a moment. We had reported on the Green News Report here not long ago with my partner Desi Doyen about a new study finding that the mean elevation of the state of West Virginia has actually been lowered, has actually sunk in a sense due to all the mountaintop removal coal mining. Where they blow the tops off of so many mountains that the state is actually has a lower elevation than they used to, in a sense.
Well, that's why I describe where I live as almost level West Virginia.
Really?
We've lost 500. Appalachia's lost 500 mountains. We've lost an area of the region equivalent to the size of the state of Delaware. Okay, 500 mountains gone. 2,000 miles of streams that are feeder streams to the greater southeastern United States, buried. Okay, you've got people poisoned by mountaintop removal, by the blasting. I mean, one ordinary mountaintop removal blast, Brad, can be the equivalent of a cruise missile strike of 25 cruise missiles.
And this goes on every day.
Every day, 3 to 5 to million pounds of high explosives per day. And the reason I said not so fast a moment ago is because, and I really wish these stories would stop propagating. I guess they make people feel better or something. Coal's not going away, okay? Coal's going to continue to be burned at present rates until we literally burn ourselves out of the ability of human beings to live on the planet, okay? That's the reality. And the fact of the matter is, while we've had a ton of layoffs in the coal industry here in West Virginia, almost all of them are underground coal miners like Tommy Davis and the people who died in Upper Big Branch. They're not laying off the mountaintop removal guys because it only takes 10 or 15 people working with a bunch of heavy equipment and explosives. It takes 10 or 15 people working 5 years to take down 5,000 acres of mountains.
It's easy,
and the coal gets on a truck, and then it gets on a train, and then it gets on a boat, and it goes to China, and it goes to India, and it goes Well, the single largest European user of mountaintop removal coal, the Netherlands, for God's sakes.
Where is the Obama administration? How have they been on this issue? Like I said, it's, you know, they are accused of waging this war on coal. Is there any truth to it? Where are they on mountaintop removal, for example?
Look, they've been in office for 8 years. I've been at protests in front of the White House. I've seen my friends arrested. The Obama administration has done next to nothing to curtail mountaintop removal. Okay, a few of us frustrated hillbillies finally took the bull by the horns, and we went and got the only bill that's ever been introduced in the Congress that would end mountaintop removal. It's called the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. We got that. That wasn't some idea the Obama administration had, and to this day, the Obama administration has never uttered a peep in support of that legislation.
Who introduced that legislation? Who sponsored that legislation in the?
It was originally introduced by Dennis Kucinich, and then in subsequent Congresses, the ball was picked up by John Yarmuth of Kentucky, and it took a lot of guts for him to do it. But we've had a lot of good progressive support on it. People like Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva. A large number of the California House delegation. We have worked the Senate tirelessly trying to get it introduced over there. But the idea of that there's a war on coal is just a sad and cynical and tragic little joke perpetrated on people who I guess they like their confirmation bias.
Over in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, you got Joe Manchin. He's a former governor out there, a Democrat, and I guess I have to put that in quotes, a Democrat from West Virginia. He won't touch this legislation in the U.S. Senate?
No, even though we know that there are more than two dozen peer-reviewed science journal articles that point to mountaintop removal as a significant aggravator, if not an outright cause, of a whole raft of horrifying diseases that plague southern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, western Virginia, and northeastern Tennessee, all the places where mountaintop removal takes place.
Hillary Clinton, for her part during this presidential campaign, she's called for a massive project to retrain coal workers, I think $30 billion in places like West Virginia, to assure that those folks losing jobs because now they're just blowing the tops off mountains. That's cheaper. That's easier. It doesn't take as many miners to do it. So she's proposing some $30 billion to retrain workers with, good paying jobs as coal is hopefully, finally, someday phased out. How is that plan being received in your part of coal country?
Where are those good paying jobs going to come from, Brad? Okay, the fundamental mistake that was made in Appalachia is that we were run as a mono economy. Okay, we were run as a resource colony for the coal industry and their Wall Street backers and their international investment banker friends like Deutsche Bank and UBS and Royal Bank of Scotland and Credit Agricole, that bunch. But since you mentioned Hillary Clinton, let me give you here, because I just happen to have it handy. Let me give you her take on mountaintop removal.
Okay.
This comes from March of 2008. She has since been as silent as a miner's grave about mountaintop removal. I am concerned about it, mountaintop removal, for all the reasons people state, but I think it's a difficult question because of the conflict between the economic and environmental trade-off that you have here. You know, maybe there, and this is the part where I run screaming out into the night, you know, maybe there's a way to recover those mountaintops once they've been stripped of the coal. You know, I think that we've got to look at this from a practical perspective.
Hillary Clinton, she was very, very troubled, very, very disturbed, understandably, by what went on up in Flint, Michigan, where they got a lot of attention, and deservedly so, for the toxic lead water poisoning crisis out there by state Republicans. But I know that folks in West Virginia, like you, have had to deal with your own toxic pollution in the water and in the air for years, thanks in no small part to things like a mountaintop removal and the coal industry.
Absolutely. And let me just, if I could, please, Brett,
sure.
Let me kind of draw a distinction between Flint is horrifying and long-term and heartbreaking. And I don't mean to be cynical in this. It's easy. It is an easy one to deal with, because all you have to do is point to those conscienceless, remorseless, avaricious Republicans who made Flint happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it did not have to be. It was not a natural disaster. It was a matter of just plain old nasty right-wing politics in action. Okay, you come down here where water's poisoned. You mm-hmm. come down here where people are sick and dying. And it becomes a little bit more difficult, perhaps, for somebody like Hillary Clinton, because, you see, the coal industry does not operate in a vacuum, Brad. These massive operations, especially a mountaintop removal job, they don't take a lot of labor. There's not a lot of labor cost there, but there is a ton of capital outlay for equipment, for drills, for massive earth-moving machinery, for blasting, for transportation of the coal, all of that kind of stuff. And that takes Wall Street, okay? And that takes the investment banks. That takes the people like Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you come down here and you go after mountaintop removal for making people sick, you're liable to get some people on Wall Street really upset with you.
And of course, it's much, much harder, therefore, to take that on than to those nasty Republicans who switched our water supply, because now you're taking on the entire panoply of people who, frankly, support Hillary Clinton. How about Bernie Sanders? Any better commentary, statement, advocacy coming from him?
A million times better. A million times better. I can say, because I've been involved in it. I've been involved in conversations with folks in Bernie's office,
mm-hmm.
and I've had a personal conversation with Bernie himself, and he knows how bad it is, and he loathes the practice of mountaintop removal, and makes no bones about it.
Bob, I've just got one about a minute here. I got to get out, but two quick questions here. One, they seem to be. I reference this, and you reference this. These coal companies, Alpha Natural Resources, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in the country, now filed for bankruptcy. Coal plants are being shut down. Coal-fired power plants are being shut down all around the country. You say coal is not going anywhere, but there is evidence to suggest, at least, that coal is at least in very serious trouble. As they're doing things like declaring bankruptcy, are they really heading out of business, or is that just a way to skirt pensions?
The bankruptcy laws are being used to allow these coal companies to streamline their operations. Granted, the price of coal fell.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons, one of which is just simple supply and demand. They overproduced.
Mm-hmm.
But the bankruptcy laws, they allow the companies to get rid of their pension obligations, to get rid of their health care obligations, to completely put the wood to all the people who showed up at all of those pro-coal rallies, right?
Yeah.
And so when they come back, I mean, it's not like they're out there, selling off earth-moving equipment and got them up on blocks or at auction. No, they're going to come back. They'll come out of bankruptcy with all of those liabilities erased from their ledger, and they will be lean and mean and ready to go forward into a toxic future.
Is there anything, Bob, to be hopeful about? I mean, it does still seem like we are turning some kind of curve here, that people are understanding finally how deadly coal is, how deadly fossil fuels are in general. Is there anything out there in West Virginia at this point to be hopeful about? Can we be more hopeful than we were, say, 7 years ago before Obama came to office? And frankly, for what it's worth, taking the impacts of climate change at least somewhat seriously, more so than his predecessors. Anything to be hopeful for? Anything to leave anybody with any hope here, Bob, at the end of the show?
Well, yeah, I'm sorry I've been such a little ray of sunshine and everything. But
well, no,
yeah, you know what's hopeful?
Yeah.
The fact that the people who do understand the reality of it aren't backing down. We're not going away. We're not going to quit. We're not going to quit living in the land of reality while other people live in a fantasy world. We're going to keep making the noise. We just need more people making noise with us.
Coal country hero Bob Kincaid, host of the Bob Kincaid Show on Head On Radio. Bob, what's the best address for people to find your show and listen to your siren song each and every weeknight on these issues?
6 to 9 p.m. is the live time, and you can get the program easily at headonradionetwork.com or on the Stitcher or TuneIn apps.
Very good, and we should say 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern time for those who don't live on the East Coast. Bob Kincaid, co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, president of Coal River Mountain Watch. Always great to talk to you, my friend. Let's do it again sooner instead of waiting so many years this time.
Let's do indeed.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Brett.
Man, I love that guy. Bob Kincaid. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and of course to Bob Kincaid of the Head On Radio Network. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it and every other one we have ever done for free at bradblog.com, or you can subscribe and get them sent to your computer or your iPhone or whatever for free over at TuneIn, where we hope you will leave us a good review. If you have any comments, good, bad, or otherwise, if you'd like to yell at me about anything you want, please feel free. My email address is bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Twitters and the Facebooks, I am simply The Bradblog. All right. Is that it? Did I hit everything, Des?
I think so.
Thank you very much. All right. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.